Tēnā koutou te whānau o Unitarians o Tamaki Makaurau. Tēnā koutou no manuhiri, no mai haere mai ki tēnei whare karakia o te atua. Ko Phoebe toki ingoa, ko Tamaki Makaurau ahau, ko Tamaki te awa, ko maungafau te maunga, ke Claremont ahau e noho ana. No reira e rau rangatira mā. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Welcome all, church whānau and visitors, to this place of worship, virtual and physical, a space made sacred by our coming together today and by gatherings of Auckland Unitarians for over 122 years. Welcome to those joining us remotely, to those here in the building, and to those watching the recording at a later time. For those here in person, you are all invited to join us for a cup of tea or coffee immediately following our service. Our opening words today are from Margaret Gooding. Why Not a Star, by Margaret Gooding. They told me that when Jesus was born, a star appeared in the heavens above the place where the young child lay. When I was very young, I had no trouble believing wondrous things. I believed in the star. It was a wonderful miracle, part of a long ago story foretelling an uncommon life. They told me a supernova appeared in the heavens in its dying burst of fire. When I was older and believed in science and reason, I believed the story of the star explained. But I found that I was unwilling to give up the star, fitting symbol for the birth of one whose uncommon life has been long remembered. The star explained became the star understood. For Jesus, for Buddha, for the Zarathustra, why not a star? Some bright stars shine somewhere in the heavens each time a child is born. Who knows what it may foretell? Who knows what uncommon life may yet again unfold if we but give it a chance? Now, please stand as you are able for the opening hymn, number 237, The First Noel. Please join me together as we say our covenant. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest for truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve humankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony, thus to be covenant with each other and with our hearts. Our first reading is from Matthew 2, verses 1 to 6. In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, asking, "Where is the child who has been born King of the Jews? For we observed his star at his rising and have come to pay him homage." When King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all Jerusalem with him. And calling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it has been written by the prophet. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel." Our second reading is from Luke 2, verses 1 through 14. In those days, a decree was issued by the Emperor Augustus for a registration to be made throughout the Roman world. This was the first registration of its kind. It took place when Quirinus was governor of Syria. For this purpose, everyone made his way to his own town, and so Joseph went up to Judea from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to register at the city of David, called Bethlehem, because he was of the house of David by descent, and with him went Mary, who was betrothed to him. She was expecting a child, and while they were there, the time the baby came for her to be born, and she gave birth to a son, her firstborn. She wrapped him in his swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them to lodge in the house. Now in this same district, there were shepherds out in the field, keeping watch through the night over their flock, when suddenly there stood before them an angel of the Lord. And the splendor of the Lord shone round them. They were terror-stricken, but the angel said, "Do not be afraid. I have good news for you. There is a great joy coming to the whole people. Today, in the city of David, a deliverer has been born to you, the Messiah, the Lord. And this is your sign. You will find a baby lying wrapped in his swaddling clothes in a manger." All at once was with the angel a great company of the heavenly host, singing the praises of God. "Glory to God in the highest heaven, and on earth his peace for men on whom his favor rests." So now I'd like to invite my dad, Jonathan Mason, to talk to us about Matthew and Luke's Christmas story. He's been very interested in the historical Jesus for decades and is really excited to talk with us about this topic today.
Ko Jonathan Mason toku, everyone. Tanakoto, Tanakoto, Tanakota, Katoa. When I go to movies, I've been told I have an irritating habit because, like, if it's a detective story or a spy thing, I analyze it after for this isn't realistic and this couldn't have happened. And when friends are honest with me, they often say, finally, it was just a movie. It was fun. Stop analyzing it. And there is a sense, as I go through the nativity story, and I'll come back to it, is that you can overanalyze this. And ultimately, it's a wonderful story, and you have to think of it like that. But for the purpose of sort of rationalist, Unitarian, Christian that I am, this has been a fascinating multi-decade journey for me. It was great to go back out, get all the books, refresh my memory on the nativity story, and what do scholars actually think happened? And that'll be the focus of my discussion. But these events occurred over 2,000 years ago, so you can believe whatever you'd like. But the power of the story is quite significant, even for Unitarians. I was surprised, you know, when I went to get hymns for this service. We have 25 hymns about Nativity. And so, quite a powerful part of our culture, even within the Unitarian Church. So I'm going to skip over something that's sort of controversial for Unitarians, the Immaculate Conception. That is part of the Nativity story, and just focus on Bethlehem. And so there's a filter that historical Jesus scholars use to evaluate what did Jesus actually say and what actually happened. And there's three filters. So I'm going to go through the three and then evaluate Nativity using the three. The first filter is, does the event occur in multiple versions of the gospel? Okay, so, and with a special focus on the synoptic gospels. So there's four gospels, and three are synoptic. Three are related. Synoptic means they had common source material that's now lost. The gospels weren't written down until the 4th century AD, but they were thought to have been written, Mark, maybe 70 AD, and then Luke and Matthew, maybe 100 AD, so 60 to 70 years after Jesus' death. So anyway, this first filter is, does the story or the parable occur in multiple gospels? And are the stories similar in the multiple gospels that they occur in? So that's filter number one. Filter number two is, are the events consistent with the practices of the Roman Empire, which was the empire at the time that Jesus lived? It's sort of, I don't think that deserves much explanation. The third filter actually is a little trickier. And it says, is the story helpful in building Christianity? And it's now a paradox here, because if it wasn't, it's more probably true. And if it was, it's more probably untrue. So let me give you there are examples here that help. So there's a lot of letters from Paul. Some scholars think were written by Paul. Some scholars think were put in, not written by Paul. And there's one letter where a couple comes to him and asks him whether they should get married. And he said, it really doesn't matter because the kingdom of God is so imminent. The kingdom of God would be this new way of living that Jesus really believed in. And scholars think that that letter is more likely to be true because it didn't happen. So they would have taken that out if there was any question on his authenticity. Paul really thought that this was imminent, you know, when he was living back in 50 AD. And so the scholars think, paradoxically, the reason they kept that in the canon. So when they put stuff into the Bible, there was all sorts of stuff they didn't put in. They made judgments on what goes into the Bible. If that's in the Bible, it was probably true. So that's a little harder filter to understand, but I'll sort of explain now these filters and how they work on the Nativity. So first, let's take the first filter. Did the Nativity occur in the Synoptic Gospels or in the Gospels in general? So Mark, the earliest Gospel, just begins with Jesus as an adult. So nothing about the Nativity in Mark. Also not in John, which is the one non-synoptic gospel. But in Matthew and Luke, it does occur. So two gospels, better than one. But unfortunately, then this is sort of a surprise to me. I never really went gospel by gospel until I prepared for this sermon. They're really different. Matthew and Luke are quite different. And what we've done in modern culture is just throw everything together from the two. But if I go back and what happened in each one, and sorry for the detail, but and Phoebe did two readings from each one. So in Matthew, Mary and Joseph live in Bethlehem. They don't need a stable. They don't need a manger. They have a house in Bethlehem. And so when Jesus was born, they're in the house. They don't move to the stable. And there's a bright star over Bethlehem. Now, scholars do wonder, like, there's supernova and stuff, but how does a star shine on a particular place? But put that aside. Think about miracles. Three magi, wise men, they call them kings, magi, wise men. They visit Herod the Great, who was an actual figure, quite an important figure, actually, in Middle East history and even in Roman history. And so they saw this star, and they believed the star was evidence that the Messiah, the King of the Jews, had been born. It had been foretold by Micah 5:2 in the Old Testament that the new Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. And so Herod asks that when you find the Messiah, could you return here and let me know where they're living? And so then the three wise men traveled to Bethlehem, found and honored Jesus with gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But then they were told in a dream that Herod actually wanted to kill Jesus, the Messiah. So the three wise men traveled back to their kingdoms by a different route, not going back to Herod. Okay? So then Herod waited for the wise men. And when he didn't hear back from them, he ordered all the babies 2 years and younger in the area in Bethlehem and the area around it to be massacred, so-called massacre of the innocents. But Joseph and Mary were long gone by this time, having been told by an angel in a dream to get out of Bethlehem and flee to Egypt. So they went to Egypt. After Herod's death, he died soon after, they returned to live in Nazareth in Galilee, where Jesus grew into adulthood. So that's in the Bible, Jesus of Nazareth. Now, that's Matthew. Turn to Luke. Luke, Mary and Joseph are living in Nazareth, not Bethlehem. They're commanded to travel to Bethlehem to comply with the Roman census, the second reading, to go to the cities of your fathers, because Joseph is from the house of David, and David was from Bethlehem. So they have to go to Bethlehem. Travel to Bethlehem with Mary heavily pregnant, couldn't find accommodation other than an innkeeper that had a manger, so Jesus was born there. Shepherds heard about the birth, visited the manger, but no star, no wise men, no kings, no magi in Luke. No Herod issuing edicts. In fact, Joseph and Mary go off to Jerusalem to have Jesus circumcised at the temple, then travel back to Nazareth after they registered for the census with Jesus in tow. Jesus of Nazareth, no Egypt stop. So I'll just want to pause and just say, I know I'm sort of probably speaking to the choir here, so to speak, but this is an example of how difficult it is to take the Bible strictly as a fundamentalist text. I mean, if I apply rational thought to this, Matthew and Luke, Joseph and Mary are living in two different places. One travels to Egypt, not the other. And I view these differences is sort of significant. Like, I mean, it's not like almost, you know, sort of overlapping. These are reasonably different, descriptions of what happened. So now, I talked to you about the three filters and sort of what happened in Luke and Matthew. Now let me go through rationally, and just use the three filters to grade the nativity story, as a Jesus scholar would. Okay, so first filter is whether multiple versions of the Gospels have it. And so the story of Jesus' birth in Bethlehem is in 2 out of 4. That's better than a lot of things in the Bible. But as we mentioned, the stories differ significantly. So I'm going to give this on a scale of 0 to 1, about a 0.5. Is that, yes, it's in 2 Gospels, but gosh, by golly, they're different. The second filter is whether it is consistent with practices in the Roman Empire. Here, not so good. So Matthew, there's no evidence of massacre of the innocents. And despite Herod's powers, quite influential in the Roman Empire, Rome would not have been happy with this. Like, I read a prophecy, so I, you know, murdered all the babies. I mean, Israel was a restive province. Rome had tremendous trouble with it. They would not have been happy. But if we go to Luke, it gets a lot worse. The census under Quirinus, 10 years after Herod's death. Okay, so it was the first census, but it was 10 years later. So either Matthew or Luke got the timetable wrong. And the Roman census was not based on, like, go to the city of your fathers. The reason you do a census in Rome was for 2 reasons. How much to tax people, and where can we get the military conscripts from? That's why they did the census. Having people travel all around the countryside, this is 42 generations back. If we were told, do a census and go to the city of your ancestors, and that was left at that, where would we go? I mean, this is quite challenging. You know, the thing about Luke, it's such a tortured explanation that it points to me, which we'll get on the third filter, is why were they so desperate to find Jesus being born in Bethlehem? And on the movie analogy, this is another irritating thing I do on movies, is I sometimes say that they should have changed that. A better way of explaining it would have been this. And so when I think about Luke, think of the good reasons, excuses that they could have gone to Bethlehem. We had a relative who was really sick. We were told by an angel to go. I mean, there would have been a lot of better things. The census thing, I just wonder how he came up with that as a leading. This is the best candidate for explanation. But anyway, so I'm going to give this like a 0 rating, actually. It's really inconsistent with the Roman Empire. So we're at 0.5 and 0. Third filter, is the story helpful in building Christianity? And the answer is a certain yes. So this Old Testament predicted that the Messiah would come from the city of David, Bethlehem. And in early Christianity, there were 2 groups that they were seeking to attract. One is they still thought of themselves as Jews. Okay, so as our previous speaker, Paul, has been talking to us about, right, in the last couple sermons, for those of you who have. So they were trying to attract Jews into Christianity. But second, very early on, when Paul went through Turkey and Greece, all these Gentiles were interested in joining. And in the Acts of the Apostles, he got them convinced you didn't have to follow Jewish law. Peter and then Jesus' brother, James, you didn't have to follow Jewish law to join this part of the Jewish church, quite a concession. So Gentiles were the other category, the other group they were trying to get. And so what do these stories do? One, they place Jesus where the Jewish Messiah is supposed to be born. Then Matthew structures the account almost like Moses, goes to Egypt, gets called back. There's all these similarities. If you look at Moses' life and what Matthew describes. And then celestial phenomena, incredibly important back then. So Augustus was born purportedly with a comet. So again, they were trying to build, this is a real Messiah. Like, there was a star that shined on Bethlehem. So they're trying to build it up. And, the 3 wise men, Gentiles. So Matthew is implicitly trying to say, Jesus was for everyone. Already at his birth, these Gentiles were going to honor him. And then if we move to Luke, Luke still talking, Jesus is Jewish. Put the circumcision episode at the temple right into his account. And then the shepherds would have been Gentiles. By the way, one little worrisome thing, I know Unitarians don't believe in the 25th of December, or a lot of them, but the shepherds are only out in their flocks in the winter from March to November. So the December is a little problematic with the shepherds. But anyway, on this scale, I'm going to really be tough, probably a little tough here. I could put a quarter point. I'm going to give that a 0 too, but because it was so helpful, them being born, Jesus being born in Bethlehem, to how Christianity was built, that it wasn't an awkward sort of thing that, gosh, it must be true. It was on the opposite end. It was really helpful. And Jesus of Nazareth, that's how it goes, Jesus of Nazareth, right through the Bible. My opinion, I'm not going to try to, everyone can have their own opinion, 2,100 years ago, Jesus was probably born in Nazareth. Like, that's who, he was from Nazareth. Why would you go to Bethlehem? So, anyway. But step back, and this is where the critic, so I'm now going to get better. I've analyzed the movie. I've talked about the inconsistencies. But it wasn't an entertaining movie. And so the Nativity, we have 25 hymns. I mean, I think we can concede it got traction over the last 2,000 years. And so when we reflect on why, I see two big ideas in it that have really got traction. One is the humble beginnings of Jesus in Luke. So the first Nativity, it was always present in Christianity, but it got big traction in the 13th century with St. Francis of Assisi. He did the first live nativity display in 1223. He also organized the Franciscan order around a vow of poverty. So Luke's account implicitly, and we could have seen this in the last Christmas Eve service, Rachel, the story you did about the farmers helping these two kids out in the outbuilding. Be compassionate to people who are less fortunate than ourselves. If the greatest spiritual leader in the Western world had to sleep, was born in a manger, shouldn't we treat our homeless with more compassion? And this contrasted a lot with ostentatious wealth that the Roman Empire had. Like, if you were an emperor, you weren't born in a manger. And then also, from time to time, this story acted as a real break on the excesses of the Catholic Church. So St. Francis, when he founded the Franciscan Order, was saying the Catholic Church had got out of sync with Jesus and the humility of Jesus. So that's the first big idea that I think comes through powerfully in the Nativity. The second symbol from the Nativity that has resonated through the ages is the light from the Star of Bethlehem in Matthew. And I noted earlier the special phenomenon, comets, bright stars, associated with the births of great people. But over the past 2,000 years, the Bethlehem Star has also come to symbolize hope and the possibility of an improved world. And I'm going to go out on a limb. I did not research how we got chalice lighting. But there is a connection between our candles, chalice lighting, and the Bethlehem Star. It's a symbol, a thousand-year symbol of hope and improvement. So I'll just go out on a limb and give you that hypothesis of how we're even influenced here by that. So in conclusion, the criticism that Mary specifically and multiple friends give me in movies is probably also valid in my talk just now. Stop looking at the details and whether it's historically accurate and consider instead what the stories are trying to say. And these stories date back 2,000 years. No question that the early Christians at 100 AD had this story. And in doing this all, thank you so much for listening. And it's been very important to me on my fourth principle. So I've had a lifelong journey of trying to search for truth and meaning in my spirituality. And this is part of the journey. Thank you for listening.
Could I invite Mary, Mom, to come extinguish the chalice? We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment we carry in our hearts until we are together again. And now, please stand as you are able for our closing hymn, number 246, O Little Town of Bethlehem. I've decided to close our service today with words from Joy Cowley, and these words hold quite special significance for me as they were read every year to open my school's carol service, so some fond memories with these. Nativity by Joy Cowley. Look now, it is happening again. Love like a high spring tide is swelling to fullness and overflowing the banks of our small concerns. And here again is the star. That white flame of truth blazing the way for us through a desert of tired ways. Once more comes the music, angel song that lifts our hearts and tunes our ears to the harmony of the universe, making us wonder how we could have forgotten. And now the magi within us gathers up gifts of gold and myrrh, while the other part of ourselves, the impulsive, reckless shepherd, runs helter-skelter with arms outstretched to embrace the wonder of it all. We have no words to contain our praise. We ache with awe, we tremble with miracle, as once again, in the small, rough stable of our lives, Christ is born. We will now have our postlude, so please sit back and enjoy Frank playing March of the Three Wise Men of the East by Franz Liszt.